Hey everybody, welcome back to the Damage Report. This is sure to be a fairly unique episode of the Damage Report, as will become clear very soon. I am Johnny Rolla, joined on a Thursday by Brett Ehrlich.
It's nice to be here, cause I am here and it's fun, Game of Thrones.
So we're gonna be talking a little bit about Game of Thrones. The reason is that, cause it's the internet and we can do whatever we want. Honestly, but I'll give you more reasons. So I'm not gonna be here tomorrow, and the season 8 premieres, the last season of Game of Thrones, something I've been waiting for my whole life. Soon I won't need to be alive, because I'll have seen it all. But anyway, that comes soon, and I wanna talk about it. So we're gonna talk about it. A little bit later on the show, we're gonna be breaking down, we have a company death pool. Who will live, who will die? We're gonna break down some of our picks, some of whom might be a little bit controversial. We're also gonna be going through a top 10 list of the worst decisions made in Game of Thrones, which should be a lot of fun.
I haven't finalized mine yet, but I'm gonna go with my gut in the moment. I have 6. Okay.
I've got 5, but I might mess with it. And we've also got some news. So we got 2 awesome guests who are gonna be joining us. So first, Noah Smith, writer for Bloomberg, is gonna come on to talk about private prisons and all the issues in the rise and expansion of private prisons inside of the US. And then Saudi Arabian women's rights activist and author Manal al-Sharif is gonna join us a little bit later on and talk about her campaign to increase rights for women in Saudi Arabia and the difficulty that she and other women like her have had in that over the years. So should be a lot of fun. We're gonna start off with a little bit of news before we launch into the important stuff, which is Westeros related. But first, new representatives like AOC and Ilhan Omar have found themselves just increasingly and brazenly attacked by the right. To me, obvious incitement to violence in some of these cases. And there are any number of different examples of this that we could provide. Ilhan Omar is currently experiencing, I think it was the New York Post that had a pretty inflammatory front page about her. But I want to talk a little bit about how much it's trickled down to different areas of the right. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was targeted by the Ohio College Republicans. Dave Leventhal was on the show, he's been on many times, tweeted in a fundraising email today, the Ohio College Republicans describe AOC as a quote, domestic terrorist, a term often reserved for the likes of Timothy McVeigh and people who kill children in their school classrooms. So here's a look at the headline of an email they sent out to their membership. AOC is a domestic terrorist. So it's pretty clear. They didn't really like finesse it at all.
Everything about this is absolutely traumatic if you keep it up. Like AOC is a domestic terrorist. That's horrifying to call her that. But any email from the college Republicans to me is the worst day of my life.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody wants that. I don't think most of the college Republicans want that. Yeah, and like how much controversy was there when Stephen Miller was labeled a white nationalist? Can you really say that? Oh, come on, can you really say that? AOC is a domestic terrorist. Yes, she is the same as anyone who has blown up a federal building or shot up a bunch of people. She's a domestic terrorist. And by the way, if it is possible for it to be worse than them just labeling this new representative a domestic terrorist, they did it to make money. Here's the rest of the email. Donating to the College Republicans is the most effective way to directly impact the future of America. My peers are being brainwashed on a daily basis by Marxist professors who hate America and capitalism. My fellow students often tell me that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a role model and that America should be more like socialist Europe. I think that's and they want money, obviously, lots of it. They want 500,000, whatever. That's a conversation that happens in college. I want America to be more like socialist Europe. That's what I say. But anyway,
I just love the 2-hour hate that is any college class where they're like, before we get to calculus, I hate capitalism. It's terrible. Read Karl Marx now.
Yeah, that's not
how it is. And also your argument is the smarter people get, the more they like something. Well, that should be a message to you.
Yeah. No, but the thing is that you don't get educated here, you just get indoctrinated. Also, I mean, it begs the question what the conservatives are doing in the class.
Also, one of the, Romney's dad, who was the, on track to however close to become the nominee for the Republican Party back in the day, he got disqualified essentially because he said he was brainwashed. Mm. And the idea that you're susceptible to brainwashing whatsoever, like, you sound pretty weak to me. Why don't you be stronger?
Exactly. So again, AOC is the one that they're targeting in this particular case, although this sort of thing has become increasingly common. And she tweeted about it. Now, this puts me in danger every time. Almost every time this uncalled for rhetoric gets blasted by conservative groups, we get a spike in death threats to refer to Capitol Police. Multiple people have been arrested trying to harm me, Ilhan, and others. At GOP, what's it going to take to stop? In response to this, college Republicans have said, That was totally, that was our mistake and our bad, and we're sorry for that. We didn't send that. It was sent in our name, but it's like totally not okay. It shouldn't have happened. I guess the thing is that email they've sent many times, the subject changes. So they just put a different subject. The email is the same. And in the past, multiple times, it's been signed by the chairman of the College Republicans there.
I was dead at the time.
Yeah. So look, they think that they can make money by scaring people about the prospect of a sitting congresswoman being a domestic terrorist. And that is why Fox News more and more brazen, I think the five, was it the five? Was it Greg Gutfeld? It might have been Kilmeade. I get them mixed up a lot. Was again implying that Ilhan Omar, I think it was yesterday, that she, her loyalty is not to America.
Kilmeade.
So again, I guess dual loyalty. We don't know exactly to where, but somewhere else. It's totally okay to smear her with that.
It was Kilmeade who, because Ilhan Omar was saying, listen, don't vilify all Islamic people or all Muslim people because some people did a thing.
Yeah.
And she was not belittling it, but was taken to have belittled it because she was speaking like off the cuff. And they seize on that and Kilmeade ask, is she even an American first? And what other, I mean, just go through her history of saying that people who carry out acts of actual terrorism should be hunted down, blah, blah, blah. But it's very frustrating to see this. And the other thing that I think we should bring up is it is so difficult to get actual domestic terrorists to be labeled domestic terrorists.
Yes.
The fact
well,
that—
Well, certain types anyway.
So, well, it's if you go through, you we did this thing, I think on Main Show, where it was like, you go through all of the acts and threats of actual domestic terrorism and what they are labeled in the actual indictments. And people need to, people who should, by all accounts, be labeled domestic terrorists are never labeled as such, even though you're trying so hard to say these are radical Islamic terrorists, call it for what it is. But when it comes to domestic terrorism, the only way you can get someone to be labeled that, apparently, is for them to advocate for positive change for most of America.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Stop
sorry,
coughing.
I don't
Stop
remember
coughing.
The. No, I'm just. I'm really.
What did you
up
have?
Here. I'm a little.
Essence
a little
of Nightshade.
No. Anyway,
goodbye.
I'm gonna keep talking. So I forget exactly what the study was, but it did imply that depending on whether the suspected domestic terrorist, so the person were should they be labeled domestic terrorist, if they're white or not, it takes like it's seven times rarer that they'll get labeled it or something. Anyway, do a little bit of Google foo and you'll find it. But yeah, that's depressing. College Republicans think that they can make money off of this. Fox News thinks that they can generate ratings for this. I mean, I'm sure if it works for the College Republicans, when we get into the thick of the next round of congressional elections, are Republican congressmen not going to be demonizing her and possibly inciting violence to make a little bit of money? I find that a little bit hard to believe. With that, let's move into other news. Taxes, the situation very different than it was thanks to Donald Trump and his tax bill, which we were told would not hurt the bottom line for the government, would stimulate the economy. Turns out all of that's kind of a lie, but there's also some other side effects too. More than twice as many companies this year as in previous years have paid zero or in fact negative taxes. And apparently as a result of the drastic slashing of the corporate tax rate under Trump early last year. At least 60 companies reported that their federal tax rates amounted to effectively zero or even less than zero, some made money. The number is more than twice as many as found in earlier studies. These are not tiny little companies. Among them are household names like Amazon, Netflix, Chevron, as well as is that the John Deere manufacturer. And so, and we're also talking about big money, of course, because these are big corporations. Instead of paying $16.4 billion in taxes, these companies enjoyed a net corporate tax rebate of $4.3 billion.
And it all went to employee salaries.
Exactly.
Right? I
hope. They installed new ball pits and smoothie stands.
You get a tractor, and you get a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah. And so in this particular case, I love how sometimes the news lines up where I saw this morning, perfect like crystallization of the Republican approach to taxes. Like say whatever you want about stimulating the economy or whatever effects supposedly it'll have down the line. What we know it'll do is rich people will bring home more money and the corporations will save a ton of money. And we're seeing that. That's borne out. That's their strategy. There are people who want to go in a different direction. And so today, Elizabeth Warren proposed a new way to tax gigantic corporations. She wants a new 7% surtax on profits of the largest corporations exceeding $100 million. But what's really interesting about it is instead of taxing corporate income as defined by the IRS, that tax would apply to the income, the profits that they report to their shareholders. Because very often, those two do not line up.
Which is insane.
Yeah.
Which is exactly the problem. Mm-hmm. It's everything is geared toward paying back your shareholders and not the people who helped make your company successful, your employees, even like your middle and lower management people. It doesn't go to them. It only goes to your shareholders. That was brilliant of her to identify that.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything like this before.
So brilliant, in fact, that people aren't going to be able to understand it, sadly.
I was thinking of maybe doing
a segment where it's like the reason that Elizabeth Warren's tweets don't get picked up the way that Donald Trump's do, or policies, is because she isn't tweeting like Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So I want to tweet on behalf of Elizabeth Warren like it's Donald Trump. So it's like, these loser billionaires tax the poor workers like idiots, traitors.
So you want to translate for her to dumb speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would be great. But no, this is a great plan. This is, and again, like, I keep making references to how much Elizabeth Warren is proposing. People wouldn't be talking about this tomorrow because she will have something new and will unfortunately have moved on. But there are so many people running and they all want to get coverage, but many of them seem to think, oh, I should get coverage because I went and I did a stump speech. No, you do it by coming up with a new plan, by proposing something that could actually fix our country's problems. That is why Elizabeth Warren gets the coverage that she does. She has her own problems, both individually and because of the bias towards women in politics. But we cover actual ideas and she comes up with the bulk of them. Anyway, with that, we are going to take a short break. We come back, private prisons, are they a good thing? We'll break it down after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We hear a lot of big assertions about private prisons and the benefits that they have over publicly run prisons, that they will save money, be instituted in a way that is more efficient, better outcomes for the prisoners as well. But is it actually working out that way as they become more and more common across the country? Joining us now to break it down is Noah Smith, Bloomberg opinion columnist. Noah, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, thank you.
Very glad to have you here. I enjoyed your piece recently in Bloomberg about this. And so I wanted to talk to you about private prisons. And it's an example of what you term sort of pseudo-privatization. Can you give an example of how that actually works?
Basically, pseudo-privatization is when you have private people making the money and administering the thing, but government actually just foots the bill. It hands it off to some, you know, private contractor and says, here's a bunch of money, do what you want with it. You know, an example is like mercenaries. No-bid contracting, no-bid government contracting is another example, and of course private prisons. So basically, you have the benefits. You have none of the benefits of, you know, privatization, even theoretically, like from competition. Instead, you just have all the downsides, which is lack of accountability.
And so I alluded to some of what are given as examples of why we should have more of these, that they will save money and stuff like that. You've looked at the actual evidence. How does it actually shake out? Do they actually make good on any of the promises made to justify them?
Well, no. So there have been a lot of studies about whether they save money, and none of the studies really finds that they save money. On a per person per day basis, they cost the same as other prisons. But ironically, because there's this sort of stereotype that they cost less, judges, when there's more private prisons, judges end up sentencing people to longer prison sentences, which actually increase total costs, and of course is bad for the people who get locked up for longer in prison.
Yeah, I found that to be really fascinating because that's not what I would have expected. What about other hidden differences between the two, things that crop up just sort of naturally from there being private prisons? What else came up in your research?
Well, there's a lack of accountability, and so you see a large amount of abuses. And then in terms of actually improving outcomes, you know, private prisons don't have any difference in recidivism, so people are just as likely to turn to a life of crime after they get out as from other prisons. So there's no real improvement there. So you're not saving on cost, and ironically, you're probably losing on cost because judges are handing out these larger sentences. And at the same time, you're having more abuses because, you know, there's just less accountability and oversight. So it's pretty much a net loss for the public to have these private prisons.
And so you talk about in the article that there are mainly, I believe it was three corporations that run the vast majority of these private prisons, correct?
That's right. And so, you know, the benefit of privatization is supposed to be that you have competition, but in practice we really don't. You know, we have these three companies dominating the entire market. And that basically removes any real benefit that privatization could give.
And obviously, because they're big corporations and there's a lot of money to be made, they do quite a bit of lobbying. And in particular, in some states rather than others, it's not necessarily equally distributed across the country. I know that recently there's been some effort from some politicians to sort of push back against the spread of these private prisons. Based on your research and the money that's sort of flowing back and forth, does it seem like that's likely to be successful?
Well, actually, the Obama administration was going to completely phase out private federal prisons. And then Trump administration came in and Jeff Sessions reversed that. So, one of the problems with this pseudo-privatization is that now you have this sort of industry that has a captive, almost monopoly and that becomes a lobby, and that becomes sort of a stable lobby that says, okay, well, now if you get rid of these private prisons, all these private prison guards will lose their jobs, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they could get jobs at state prisons or whatever, but that's what they'll say. And they'll become friends with the politicians, and it just becomes really entrenched. And so the pseudo-privatization just becomes a self-perpetuating thing that I think is just bad for everybody.
Yeah, and it's similar to what we see in other industries, although as you point out, the fact that we were apparently close to having a big change, a big reform in this area, and then having that snatched away is even worse in comparison to some other examples. Well, Noah Smith, thank you for joining us on the show. Everyone should go and they should read your article available at Bloomberg. We appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
We're going to take a short break. We come back transitioning to something a little bit lighter after this. Okay, it's time to talk Game of Thrones. In a lot of ways, Game of Thrones is a story of people making hard decisions and often decisions that they immediately regret. And so in this video, we're gonna break down the 10 worst decisions in Game of Thrones history. Brett, you've been going through your list. What is your number five?
Number five is Daenerys not listening to Lady Olenna. There is a time when Lady Olenna takes, first of all, spoiler alert, blah, blah, blah.
Oh yeah, no, this is obviously all spoilers. So if you haven't watched all of season 7, don't watch this.
No, go watch season 7 now. We'll wait, come back, yes. Watch all the show. Okay, so Lady Olenna, the Queen of Thorns, the prickly, funny, hilarious,
the sassy, witty, sassy older woman. Yes.
She goes, she's awesome. So at a time when Daenerys is taking too much advice from her, from Tyrion and everyone on trying to play the politics of Westeros, Lady Olenna says, "The lords are sheep. Just if you're a dragon, be a dragon." She does not act like a dragon. She does not just immediately storm King's Landing. And she loses most of her allies in this weird and attempt at being the diplomatic conqueror.
Yeah.
That doesn't need to happen. She should have listened to Lady Olenna, who knew that for so long. It ends up actually costing Lady Olenna the ultimate price.
Yeah. Yeah, and when she does finally be a dragon, it starts to work for her.
It works.
Yeah.
But we've lost time and we've opened ourselves up to an ongoing war with Cersei and company. Yeah. As you try to tackle the true menace in the North, when you could have gotten rid of that just by listening to Lady Olenna.
This is one of, like, so I was saying in the break that this series generally doesn't do the thing where people make bad decisions to benefit the plot. This is one of those. She comes, she's too strong, they can't have her just win, yeah. So they come up with excuses for her to not just attack King's Landing, but it doesn't really read.
Yeah.
Okay, my number five is, this is the most reasonable wrong decision, but he does regret it. It's the viper taunting the mountain when he's got the mountain on his back. Like, dude, you won. Nobody thought you were going to win, but you won. Somehow you won. You got what you wanted, but it wasn't enough. And so you start taunting him, and your brains end up scattered all over the cobblestones. And it was devastating. Mm-hmm. Awesome scene. Good job there. But Pedro Pascal was such a good actor. I would have loved to have gotten another season or two out of him.
Yeah, that is a great answer. It is a frustrating thing, and that one's the kind that gets more frustrating when you watch it again.
Yeah.
Watching it again, I'm like, oh my God. A, that scene plays out so magnificently. The mm-hmm. first time you watch it, they build the tension that you don't know what's happening. It is an onslaught from the get-go mm-hmm. of the viper taking down the mountain, and you're like, this isn't going to work. Oh my God, it's great.
Yeah, he's doing it.
And it also benefits—
You're doing it, Peter, you're doing it.
But it also benefits— from this weird thing where you're watching, be like, this is like the third trial by combat. It's gonna work for him again? How are they gonna get away with the champion defeating the one who represented law to begin with? But it just is so devastating.
It is devastating.
And not to mention physically disgusting. Wrecking you to watch.
It's just disgusting. Yeah.
Okay. For me, number four is Renly not siding with Stannis.
Yeah.
It is very frustrating because if you're Renly and Stannis is your bro, literally, and he's older than you, and you're claiming some kind of, natural line of succession, of course, Renly does realize that politics are at play here, but he has no claim to that throne.
Yeah.
None.
Well, and the thing is, too, I don't really remember in the books exactly how it plays out. But we don't know enough about Renly to set up that he would spurn his brother and try to take it for himself.
Well, he does have a moment with Ned Stark in the Capitol where he's like, listen, no one would follow Stannis. He's not good. We hate him. So yeah, I'm going to cut some corners and I have more people.
That's all true, but to turn against your family is one of the biggest things a character can do in Game of Thrones, and that one really isn't set up.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work out for him.
Yeah, so you've pointed out to me, that mine two are weighted down in horribility of decision, essentially because they don't necessarily feel motivated by the thing that makes Game of Thrones great, which is characters who make decisions based on what they value.
This one I might just not be remembering.
These are plotty, and I get it, but just so you know, that is why they're at the bottom of my top five list.
Well, my number four is a weird one, but it's kind of a pair. The way that the slavers act doesn't make any sense. So they sell 8,000 Unsullied to Daenerys Targaryen, and shockingly, she turns against them, which nobody was expecting. But like anybody could have done that, with or without dragons. You've got an army standing in the middle of your city, you hand over ultimate control with no controls of your own on that. Why wouldn't anyone sack your city?
Say that? Wait, what?
He hands over the whip, he gets his dragon.
Oh, yeah.
She's got 8,000 soldiers. That's 99% of the soldiers in the city. Why wouldn't they take over?
Yeah, he was blinded by his dragon wanting.
I guess he did want the dragon.
This all happened so fast to him.
It did.
Because he was like, listen, you're going to get 20 of those dudes probably because you look pretty poor.
Yeah.
Then it's, hey, dragon. And she's like, and he's like, yes, I want that. Didn't really think it through. He has a dragon. Yeah.
They probably don't sell thousands at a time normally.
Right.
And then they sail to Meereen knowing that she has dragons, you fools.
Yeah.
Anyway, they made some bad business decisions.
Yeah, but they are pretty effective when they bind together by the order of the harpy or whatever it is.
That's true. They got some gains there.
Okay.
Okay, what's your number three?
My number three is not marrying the Frey girl.
Oh, yeah.
Dude. You can,
but
listen,
Talisa.
I understand that Una Chaplin's one fine human being.
She's great.
She is not only a great doctor, But oh, doctor.
No, but they also, they really bond and.
That's true love, I saw.
It is true love.
And who would blame him?
Yeah.
Because I was in love with her and I never met her.
Jesus.
But you made a promise to the Freys, you didn't marry the Frey girl, and as a result, you lost everything for your family. So that was real stupid.
Yeah, a lot of people died because he happened across this nurse woman. Yeah, that was a bad call. Mm. My number three has to do with Littlefinger. Littlefinger's thing is that he is the manipulator. He thinks about more options. He is playing 10-dimensional chess. All of that. And all of it's basically true. He is what drives the plot initially of the whole series. Super smart and clever. But his ultimate flaw is that he can't stop telling people how manipulative and clever he is. That undercuts your ability to deceive people if you keep telling them, like, I'm working behind the scenes. And that trains Sansa to not trust him. It trains her to be able to tell when he's manipulating her. And that ultimately gets his throat slit. Because he couldn't stop bragging about how much smarter and more deceptive he was than everyone else.
Do you think he actually loved Sansa?
On some level, I don't think he had the ability that everyone else does necessarily to feel true emotions. But I think he was attracted to her. I think he did protect her more than he needed to, maybe.
Even on the rewatch, it wasn't very clear to me whether he was using that. Because he does give her over to
that's true.
The Boltons. The one central theme is like, don't love anyone. One of the central themes is don't love anyone because you're going to be blinded by that and you're going to lose everything.
He does. Yeah.
And it's, his thing was one of hubris, I think, more than it was like the overshare was based on hubris more than it was like.
Maybe. Maybe he thought, I've got the veil now, it's all coming together, but he hadn't won yet.
Yep. Number two for me, Cersei using the faith militant.
Well, that was a bad call. You're right.
So stupid. And rewatching it, you're like, ugh, this arc. Because you're so stupid.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more complex in the books, but in both cases, you're right. You really thought that, you know what's controllable? Religious extremism.
Yeah.
No, that's a bad call.
She thought it would be great. She did it very short-sighted because she's getting so protective of her son and she doesn't want to give him away. Mm-hmm. Fine, buy him an action figure or something.
Yeah,
cat. Buy his affection. Don't go through the faith militant to get his wife locked up.
Yeah, and if you are going to blow up everyone that this kid loves and trusts now, like be in the room with him when you do that.
Yeah.
That'd be a good call. My number two was Theon deciding to turn on Robb Stark.
That's a great one.
To rekindle his relationship with his family that he doesn't know, that he hasn't known since he was a little boy. Like, Theon was living his best life. He was riding at the side of the young wolf. He was winning in battles. Like, he had it all. He would have ended up getting a holdfast or something like that in the north. Instead, he ends up with the sausage situation and all the other bad stuff that's happened to him. And it all comes back to him turning on Robb.
What an amazing actor.
He's a very good actor.
And that is
underrated, I think.
And that is one where it's motivated by the character. I see that internal struggle happening and playing out.
Okay. But you fool. And he knows it. And when Ramsay makes him think that he's escaping and is leading him away, and Theon admits that he was wrong, he chose wrong, he should have chosen the Starks. Mm-hmm. I love that scene more than almost any other scene in the series because he's admitting that, not under torture. He's admitting that when he thinks he's already escaped.
Yeah.
And he still knows what he did wrong. And I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your number one?
Number one is Ned Stark not going with Renly.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Spoiler alert, that's my number one too.
Yeah, okay, so we can agree on that. And it really is so amazing. Why do you think it's your number
one? Well, my number one is specifically warning Cersei.
Yeah.
Like you're gonna have to do something difficult. He's even willing to compromise his ethics a little bit working with Littlefinger, but he still feels like he has to warn Cersei. He has to protect the kids and all that. He tells her she can flee. He doesn't know her at all. He doesn't know how this game is played at all.
But that is the most Game of Thrones thing, and it's the most significant decision for redefining how television works in America.
Yeah.
Because before that there was hero armor. Before that there was, oh, I know him. He's the leading actor who I recognize in the series. He'll be around forever. And watching it back is utterly different than watching it the first time through. Watching it the first time through, I did not see it coming whatsoever. Rewatching it, I see it coming
a mile away
from the first scene, essentially, of the movie. Because now I look at Game of Thrones, I look at all television the way I look at Game of Thrones, which is not the good guy wins because he's good and the bad guy loses and acts every way because he's bad. Game of Thrones is about they have words, they have a philosophy that governs all of their actions, and they live by that and die by that.
Yeah.
And he did it, and there is virtue and value to all those things, but at the end of the day, it was his undoing because he had honor but no strategy. And you see everybody that is still alive, for the most part, say, that's a dumb strategy, bud.
Yeah.
And say, come with me. This is about practical survival more than it is pledging yourself to some weird honor that is thousands of years old.
Yeah, he was ill-equipped for that situation. He was a battle commander. That's what he was. He wasn't even really a fighter. He was a soldier. And now he has to be involved in all this politics and everything. And he didn't want to be there in the first place. He's one of the only people who didn't want any of the power that was given to him. And I love how the same process he went through is visited on Rob. Rob makes some of the same mistakes. Mm-hmm. And then to John, they talk about how he's doing the same thing. And we'll see if, you know, what happens the third, you know, if the third time is the charm in this case. But yeah, it just such bad decisions on his part. And it was so long ago, I read it initially. I don't even remember, but I was shocked. I know I was shocked, but I can't even remember how shocked I was.
Yeah.
Terrible decision, Ned Stark. Anyway, let's see in season 8 how many bad decisions are made. There's a lot of room. Some people, Jamie's potentially switching sides. Tyrion is going to confront Daenerys and Jon over their new relationship. There's a lot of room for people to make more bad mistakes.
Yep.
Yeah. And we'll be doing reviews for The Young Turks, so get ready for those. We are going to take a short break, though. When we come back, more to get to after this. The battle for increased women's rights and human rights more generally in Saudi Arabia has continued, and joining us now is one who has fought for many years in this area, activist and author Manal Sharif. Manal, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you on, and I'm very excited to learn more about one of your projects that you're working on right now. This is your Freedom Drive campaign. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's the Drive for Freedom campaign, and you can follow it on the freedomdrive.com. And I wanted to do cross-country drive in Saudi Arabia when the official ban when it was officially lifted on the driving, women driving in my country. Unfortunately, I couldn't do that cross-country drive with my son, living now in a self-imposed exile after the arrest and imprisonment of all the women who fought for the right to drive in Saudi Arabia. They're still under in prison, facing trial. And I thought the best way to do it to raise awareness about these women cases is to do the same drive I planned, but here in the US and cross country. So I'm starting from west to east, from San Francisco all the way to DC. But on my 40th birthday, it just coincidence that it will be my 40th birthday, I'll be standing in front of the Saudi embassy in DC, where the Saudi Arabia assigned the first female ambassador in our history to be there.
So can you tell us a little bit about, I had read, it wasn't too long ago that these arrests were made of these activists. And so you're saying they're still in prison. Is there any hope that they will be released? And what is the actual state of the ability to drive of women in Saudi Arabia?
It's interesting. They've been in prison for nine months. The first few months they were in secret prison where they were subject to torture by the officials. Under the supervision of Saud al-Bihtani, the personal advisor of the Crown Prince. Later on, they moved them to state prison. And they're facing a trial, two of them been released, and Iman al-Nafjan and Aziz al-Yusuf been released, Lujain al-Hadloul and other non-activists are still there in jail, facing trial for treason, and that means around 20 years in jail, or maybe execution. The drive is really to bring awareness to these women cases. The human rights organization in Saudi Arabia, the unofficial number, states that around 15,000 arbitrary imprisonments happened in the last year. A lot of them were forced disappearance, I'm following closely the case of Abdulrahman Sathan. They took him from his work in March 2018. His family never heard of him. A prisoner met him in jail. That prisoner told his family, and that prisoner's family told Abdulrahman Sathan family. And it's really worrying, and it's really raising a lot of questions. Why these arrests? Why the torture? And by the way, Abdulrahman Sathan was one of the people who anonymously used to tweet and criticize the Saudi government. How did they find all these anonymous Twitter accounts? How did they find the owners of these anonymous Twitter accounts? That's something I'm trying to put my finger on. So I'm working closely with I work in information security. We've been trying to find out, I'm working closely with other tech companies to find out how the Saudi government can locate and hunt down these activists, even if they are anonymous online.
I wanted to get your perspective a little bit more broadly on the situation in Saudi Arabia having to do with Mohammed bin Salman, who, at least early on, as someone working in media in America, it seemed like he was really embraced by economic and political elites inside of the US and in some countries in the EU as well. We had all these cover stories about what a reformer he was going to be and how everything was going to be different. And it seems like over the past 6 months or so, perhaps because of the conflict in Yemen, perhaps because of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, that situation has changed at least somewhat. From your perspective, what do you think about his relationship with these foreign countries?
When he came to the power as Saudis, we were really hopeful. We were hungry for change. We were actually desperate for change. And everyone held when he came to the power because he's young. And the first few months for him, he did really great things. Like one of them was he was putting ban on the arrest power for the religious police. And that really was a big relief for us in Saudi Arabia. It's never happened in the history of the country. We were really hopeful, but with this, and I know he used the woman card also because women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia have been very loud about the guardianship system and how they've been enslaved in a country where a woman, each woman, regardless of her age, is assigned a male guardian. And that, I think, brought the media attention and scrutiny to Saudi Arabia when it comes to their history of how they treated women. He used the same card for his PR. Successfully, I would say, and effectively, when he lifted the ban. It was really economically neat, lifting the ban, but the women who were fighting all these years for this right been punished severely. He said himself, I've never claimed that I'm a reformist. The media been calling me that, giving me that title, but I've never claimed this title. And it's true, he never said that about himself. He just wanted to come and diversify the economy in the country, but the price that we pay as Saudi citizens and the world actually is paying is really high. More Saudis are running away, are fleeing the country, whether applying for asylum, like Saudi women. There are 80 reported cases in Australia today. That's the country I chose to live in, a self-imposed exile. 1,000 cases was recorded in 2018 of asylum seeker from Saudi Arabia. After Jamal Khashoggi, I think Jamal Khashoggi assassination, brutal assassination, and the way he was dismembered, and the CIA investigation came with one result, one conclusion, that this type of operation would not be carried out without the blessings and the knowledge of the Crown Prince. The reaction to that assassination was really disappointing, the international reaction, especially the reaction of the U.S. administration. Apparently, they continue giving him logistic support when it comes to the Yemen war. They continue giving him support when it comes with all these human rights violations. We've been calling for Magnitsky Act, Human Rights Accountability Act, where you have targeted sanctions to the officials, the Saudi officials, that were involved in Jamal Khashoggi case and the imprisonments of these women rights activists.
Well, Manal, I want to thank you for joining us on the show, breaking down that situation. I'm excited to see what happens with your campaign. And I also wanted to direct people to your book. It is Daring to Drive, My Life as an Accidental Activist in a Kingdom of Men. Thank you again for joining us on the Daily Report.
John, can I just, you can follow the hashtag #IDrive4Freedom to follow the drive. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, just a little bit more for you. just a couple of days, season 8, the last season of Game of Thrones is gonna happen. We've got 6 episodes and a lot of characters are not gonna make it through all 6. And so we here at TYT are engaging in a Game of Thrones Deadpool, choosing who will live and who will die and competing for just a little bit of money. So in this video, I just wanna talk with Brett. There it goes.
John made that, by the way, and if
you
thought he had 0 talents, I understand, but he does have them.
I have half a talent. So you can go to twitter.com/thedamagereport to download this if you would like to participate. Obviously not as a paying part of it or anything, but you can have fun with it and follow along as we do our reviews. So Brett, what were some easy calls? What were some hard calls?
Easiest calls are Melisandre and Varys. So the Red Witch and the Bald Eunuch. Mm-hmm. Because there is an interaction. They're going to die because they have an interaction on in, I think, Dragonstone, where she just says that. She's like, I have to die in this country just like you. And he goes, don't tell me that.
Spoiler.
I don't like that.
She's been wrong before. But I did also put down that they're both going to die based on that interaction.
Thank you. How about you? What's okay. An easy peasy?
An easy one is my theory for a lot of these is, I think we will end with magic once again transitioning out of the world. Magic came back during the series, I think it will go. So I think all 3 of the dragons are gonna die. I don't know if that's an easy or a hard one. I think the one that has already died is gonna die again, and then the other 2 will also die. So I have Viserion, Rhaegal, and Drogon all dying. That's my theory. And I also believe that's why Melisandre has to die. I think that Beric Dondarrion is gonna die. He was brought back to accomplish something, but he's again a magical guy.
I do have Beric Dondarrion, the only Armenian in the cast. He's gonna be there.
Is he?
I don't know, but Dondarrion. I'm like,
I guess,
it sounds
that's
like
true.
Every time I hear it, it just takes me out for a second.
What is a controversial pick that you have?
So we've done the easy peasy lemon squeezy.
What's
the difficult lemon difficult? You might ask.
It's less popular, but yeah, what's difficult?
I think Daenerys is done.
Really?
She's
I do
dead.
Not have her down
live.
Yet.
She does not have to live. I mean, there is no have to. And that's what's so frustrating about doing this poll is it doesn't really matter, phrasing. It doesn't really matter, poll. Anyways, it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. It just might come down to, and it sucks that George R. R. Martin dresses like the captain from Captain and Tennille. It's just like this pirate guy just being like, I did this to you.
Yeah.
But there's no need for Daenerys or her dragons really to survive because we find that Jon Snow is actually who he is. And as a result, like, if there is a justice in this world that we're going to gravitate toward, it doesn't need to involve Daenerys.
So I understand that this is not a popular opinion because it's too much like what other TV is like. But I actually believe that Daenerys and Jon Snow will both survive. I think that she will lose her dragons, but have a child. I do think that she is pregnant or will be soon. And I think that they will actually rule.
I think, here's my Humperdinck choice.
Yeah.
My to the pain person choice is I think Cersei lives.
No, nope.
I think Jaime tries to kill her, fails, and dies. I think that Cersei lives, marries Jon Snow. They say that that's his kid, and order is restored.
That's dumb. That's dumb. That's so dumb.
It is dumb.
He's not marrying Cersei.
And it's this weird, like, I have been absolutely tormented by this series into thinking this is some kind of messed up thing that George R. R. Martin will do.
You're a dummy.
Because George R. R. Martin is short for George R. Martin.
Yes. Okay, so I have one quick set of deaths. I think there will be several people who will get to die an honorable death, protecting someone or saving someone. Mm-hmm. I think Theon will die early in the season, saving Yara
and restoring his.
Yes, I think Jaime will die in Brienne's arms, having done something. I don't know what.
I'm with you.
I think Jorah Mormont dies to save Daenerys. I think he's earned it.
Yeah, he's done.
I think Gregor Clegane will get killed by Sandor, I hope. I think Bran is gonna die. Again, I don't see him surviving as this magical raven guy. I think he's gone. I haven't decided about Arya and Sansa yet, but I do think Bran is gonna die.
Arya's done, Sansa lives.
Arya might die.
All the people who are good, like the Onion Knight, done.
I haven't decided on him, I just love him so much. Grey Worm, no, Grey Worm and Missandei. They last. They have a spin-off
Miss
show.
No, Missandei, actually, she
don't put an X on her.
Teleports to my house. The I think that the original.
Well, we got to wrap it, unfortunately, but we will be doing reviews. You can follow those reviews on the Young Turks. Become a member, you'll get them. We'll be breaking down every episode as it happens. Thank you, Brett, for joining us. Great to have you here. Thank you, everybody, for putting up with us, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.